Welcome to The Bridge, a twice-weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your host for the show. Have you thought about what climate change could mean for your stock portfolio? A Securities and Exchange Commission rule requires companies to inform their investors about climate-related risks.
We've already seen lots of physical impacts, and we see regulations affecting companies. And so the real question for investors is which industries and which specific companies are most at risk and which are taking advantage of the opportunities.
John Ryan explains how a citizen researcher has delved into hundreds of company filings but found little mention of the required disclosures. That story coming up. Also on the show, 50 years ago today, President John F. Kennedy visited the N reactor at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in southeast Washington. Correspondent Anna King reports the visit was to demonstrate the peaceful use of nuclear power and help cool down the Cold War. This is Coast Community Radio. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. In top local and regional stories this morning, members of the public will be able to speak to key Oregon state lawmakers today and tomorrow about the tax, pension, and local GMO regulation issues to be considered during Oregon's special session. Public comment on GMO regulation will only be taken today. Today's hearing begins at 2:15 p.m. The public will be allowed to weigh in after lawmakers question experts. Tomorrow's hearing begins with more expert testimony at 9 a.m. Public comment tomorrow will be limited to the tax and pension issues. Both will be held at the state capitol in Salem. The public can also call or email lawmakers. Clatsop County property tax bills will be mailed out the third week of October. County officials say market values in many areas have gone down, but that may not translate to lower taxes. Taxes are based on assessed value, not market value. Voter-approved levies or bonds may also affect the tax bills. Tax payments for 2013 are due on or before Friday, November 15th. More information can be found on our website, coastradio.org. Just click the news button on the homepage. Oregon State Representative Brad Witt announced this week he will seek a sixth term in the Oregon House of Representatives. In a statement, he said he will work for family wage jobs and education. The National Weather Service in Portland says evidence of a funnel cloud was reported just before noon yesterday near Albany, Oregon. The service said the cloud was not known to have touched the ground and likely dissipated quickly. A disturbance off the coast with an associated jet streak was the likely source of energy for the funnel cloud. A jet streak is a portion of a jet stream with a relatively higher velocity wind. Chinook salmon caught by sport fishers on the Lower Columbia will no longer need to be fin-clipped in order to be retained. Effective today, fishery managers on Tuesday decided to allow anglers to harvest both marked and unmarked Chinook throughout a 58-mile stretch of the Columbia between Buoy 10 and Warrior Rock. Prior to the rule change, anglers were required to release any unclipped Chinook in this stretch of the river. This restriction was set to expire on September 30th, but was lifted 5 days early based on new ocean harvest information and because wild Chinook destined for Lower Columbia tributaries have likely moved out of the main stem. Coho salmon and steelhead in the area are still subject to the restriction and must be fin-clipped in order to be retained. On Tuesday, the Astoria City Council held a public hearing and first reading of an ordinance that would boost the dollar amount of fines levied under the derelict building ordinance. City Attorney Blair Henningsgaard drafted the change to bring Astoria's code in compliance with Oregon state law. Under the new ordinance, fines greater than $1,000 could be levied for a derelict building's rules violations. Another code change drafted by Henningsgaard, a title change in a code section from the wording public indecency to offensive public conduct. The change would take away a requirement that those convicted of offenses such as public urination or nude bathing register as sex offenders.
The title is being amended because the former title required that people who are convicted of it register this with the state as sex offenders. And although we don't cite very many skinny dippers. It didn't seem very appropriate that require skinny dippers to register as sex offenders.
Henningsgaard also drafted a change in rules prohibiting the carrying of loaded firearms in public places that would bring Astoria's code in line with Oregon statutes. Those licensed to carry a concealed handgun, members of the military and law enforcement officers would be among those exempted from the ordinance. Also on Tuesday, City Manager Paul Benoit updated the council on work to acquire the Armory Building currently owned by the Columbia River Maritime Museum. No longer needed as a storage facility, the museum board decided to sell the building. The city is considering the acquisition of an adjacent vacant lot to the north in order to protect parking for the Coast Guard and the 17th Street Pier. Benoit explained some of the terms of a tentative agreement between the city and the museum.
What we're proposing to do is trade the museum. We would give them between 100 and 150 feet. Our ownership extends 800 feet all the way to the mill pond. What we would do is transfer somewhere between 100 and 150 feet of our land to the Maritime Museum so that it can support depot operations for their exhibits, parking, events that they're doing at the depot. In addition, the city would move to vacate Duane Street. If you go down to the Astoria Builder Supply, if you go down 18th Street and you turn into the old facility, between the two buildings, the big retail building, and then there's the lumber storage that's over by the old blacksmith shop behind the Moose building, that's actually Duane Street. It looks like and functions like the Astoria Builder Supply driveway, but it's actually an established right-of-way. We would move to vacate Duane Street. That would allow the Maritime Museum to completely control the property that they purchased for artifact storage. They're going to have very valuable goods there. They need to gate that off and control access. Lastly, we would propose giving the Maritime Museum $250,000 in cash. That would be through the Urban Renewal District. So it would be $250,000, property east of the depot, the vacation of Duane Street. In return, the Maritime Museum would deed over the Armory Building in its entirety, as well as the entire block that's now used by the Coast Guard for parking.
The purchase and trade would benefit the city by protecting parking for the Coast Guard at the 17th Street Pier, benefit the Maritime Museum by adding to their overflow parking by the Barbie Center, also known as the Old Train Depot, and promote the preservation of the Armory Building by providing a fixed price to a nonprofit, Friends of the Armory Group, to aid in their purchase of the building. If you own stocks or have money in a retirement plan, your money may be more at risk than you've been told. Most publicly held companies, including some of the biggest companies in the Northwest, aren't informing investors of the risks they face from climate change. John Ryan reports from Seattle.
Companies that trade on the stock market have to tell their investors what risks they face by investing in those companies. The Securities and Exchange Commission imposed that rule more than 40 years ago to help prevent financial fraud. Just 3 years ago, the SEC told companies they need to acknowledge how climate change might hurt their bottom line. Most companies are brushing off the new SEC rule. That's according to a citizen researcher in California who pored over thousands of companies' financial filings. Lawrence Taylor found that only about a quarter of companies on the stock market even mentioned climate change in their required discussion of financial risks. His findings echoed those of investors who monitor how big business is responding to climate change.
It's a serious risk for the economy.
Jim Coburn is with a coalition of investors and environmental groups called Ceres.
We've already seen lots of physical impacts, and we see regulations affecting companies. And so the real question for investors is which industries and which specific companies are most at risk and which are taking advantage of the opportunities.
Coburn says the lack of disclosure in the SEC filings is a sign that companies aren't taking climate change as seriously as they should.
And if companies don't address these issues, people face a lot of losses in their portfolios.
If you search through the annual SEC filings, you can see that climate change is rarely mentioned. Companies are only required to do so if they believe climate change is a financial threat. I search through the annual filings of Washington's biggest companies. I look for the words climate, warming, greenhouse, and carbon. Those words were nowhere to be found in the filings of PACCAR, Nordstrom, Starbucks, or Expeditors International. Amazon.com discusses the economic climate, but says nothing about the actual climate. Costco and Microsoft acknowledge that extreme weather could hurt their operations and that climate policies could increase energy costs. Of the Fortune 500 firms based in Washington, only Weyerhaeuser reveals any details about how climate is affecting the bottom line. The Weyerhaeuser filing says regulations could affect its biomass energy projects and that the company is positioning itself to exploit opportunities created by climate change policies. The company has also reduced its greenhouse gas emissions by nearly a third over the past decade. The SEC filing for the state's largest private employer, that's Chicago-based Boeing, mentions carbon, but only as a raw material for its carbon fiber planes. I'm John Ryan in Seattle.
Classes begin next week at state universities around Oregon. Some young undocumented immigrants will be paying in-state tuition rates rather than out-of-state rates that are 3 to 4 times higher. As KLCC's Jacob Lewin reports, this year Oregon becomes one of 15 states with a tuition equity program.
Hugo Nicolás's dream came true just last Wednesday afternoon when he unlocked the mailbox at his apartment complex.
A letter. I'm going to go ahead and open it. Dear Hugo, I am pleased to offer you admission to the University of Oregon for the fall 2013 term.
Hugo, who's from Salem, will be going to the U of O. He is one of the first in the state to take advantage of the new tuition equity law. Young, undocumented immigrants who graduate from Oregon high schools can now pay in-state tuition for the first time if they show intent to become citizens. A year ago, Hugo became part of the Federal Deferred Action Program, under which some young immigrants can't be deported. That also shows his intent to become a citizen. But the $500 to enter the program wasn't easy to find.
The only way we could afford it, my parents worked minimum wage jobs. What they did was that they sold their car.
Hugo is the kind of kid you'd expect to go to a four-year college. A police and fire cadet, 3.6 grade point average, ROTC commander. He even won a high school essay contest. But his parents brought him here from Veracruz, Mexico, when he was 11. In high school, he didn't think he'd be able to make it past community college. U of O in-state tuition is $8,500. But for Hugo, it would have been over $27,000, the out-of-state rate. Still, he never considered returning to Mexico.
If I would have gone back to Mexico, it would have been like running away from my problems. When I was in high school, I realized how hard it was going to be for me to go to school, or impossible. And, you know, I wanted to make sure that maybe that was not going to be the case for me, but maybe I could make it happen for people younger than me.
This year, tuition equity was one of the most controversial issues faced by the Oregon legislature. Representative Michael Dembro championed the bill during the floor session, saying the state has already invested in these kids.
Many have lived here virtually their entire lives. They did not choose to come here. They were brought here. They have no other country to go to, but they have plenty to offer this state. Unfortunately, they've become the collateral damage of this country's immigration debate.
Backers predict only 38 undocumented young people in Oregon will take advantage of the program this fall and next, so state costs should be minimal. But State Senator Doug Whitsitt argued that those figures are not credible, and costs will be significant.
There's as many as 210,000 undocumented aliens in the state of Oregon. This number of people is about equal to the entire population of Eugene, Springfield. And colleagues, we are being asked to believe that a city the size of Eugene, Springfield would offer up only 38 children to 7 universities.
Oregon University System Chancellor Melody Rose says that number should increase to 100 in 2 years' time, but contends it's still an economic win for the state.
Students who gain a college degree over the course of their life more than pay for the cost of that degree in their own income, in contributions to the tax system, and of course in avoiding social services that they might otherwise access.
And she says these students won't be eligible for federal or state aid, and $8,500 is still a lot of money.
Cost is a barrier to all low-income students, regardless of documentation status. Students in the United States are growing increasingly price sensitive. So it shouldn't surprise us that undocumented students on the lower end of the economic spectrum would find a real barrier there.
So even with in-state tuition, Hugo didn't think he was going to a four-year school. Then this summer, he got a call from a mentor of his, an Oregon judge.
He asked to have dinner with my parents and ourselves. And after that, him and his wife said that they wanted to pay for my education. And University of Oregon was like way beyond my dreams. But once he said that, you know, I was like, my dreams were in a hold, and now, you know, I have that chance.
Ugo plans to study economics and Chinese and maybe pursue a law degree. In Salem, I'm Jacob Lewin.
Still ahead, a look back at Northwest history. Our Salem correspondent Chris Lehman got a tour of the Oregon Capitol building ahead of its 75th anniversary next week. His tour guide is the same age as the building.
I was born the year the Capitol was built, and so I think I have a special feeling about the building. I shouldn't admit that, but I am 75 years old.
An audio postcard from Salem. Also, Anna King reports on a visit President John F. Kennedy made to the Hanford Nuclear Reservation 50 years ago today. Those stories just after this weather break. You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane with Northwest Weather. The time is now 9:19. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Partly sunny after some patchy morning fog. Highs in the low 60s today with light winds becoming northwest 10 to 15 miles per hour this afternoon. Then tonight, partly cloudy early this evening. Mostly cloudy overnight with lows 45 to 50. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says this will be a nice day with mostly sunny skies, warming up to the mid-60s, though it may feel cooler with a north wind around 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow could see a foggy start, then a front passes to our north, increasing our cloudiness and giving us a slight chance of rain starting in the afternoon, which increases further tomorrow night and Saturday. After that, a cold front passes through the area, so look for a rainy Sunday and Monday, with showers continuing into Tuesday. Highs by the start of next week could be up around 70, lows around 55. You've seen those safety posters marking so many days since a workplace injury. Oregon State Capitol building could have one that says, 75 years without burning to the ground. The original two buildings went up in flames. Now a series of events scheduled next week will mark the 75th anniversary of Oregon's third and longest standing state capitol building. The celebration comes as lawmakers consider a $300 million overhaul. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman works in the Capitol every day, but he'd never taken a tour until now.
Frankie Bell is perhaps the ultimate state capitol tour guide. She's worked in the building for more than half its existence.
I was born the year the Capitol was built, and so I think I have a special feeling about the building. I shouldn't admit that, but I am 75 years old.
Bell agreed to show me around the building and point out a few of the things I walk past on a daily basis without even noticing.
The first place we go is the rotunda, because it really exemplifies everything about our history. It's 106 feet to the top. There are 33 stars on the ceiling, and of course, Oregon is the largest one.
Oregon being the 33rd state to join the Union, Bell is in full tour guide mode now and walks me through a detailed description of all the symbolism depicted in vivid murals around the rotunda. But standing in here, you just can't help but look straight up into the Art Deco dome.
It kind of has what seems to me like a traditional feel to it, but from the outside it has a non-traditional look to it.
One of the comments about the building after it was built was that it looked like a birthday cake, and it took a long time for people to get used to the idea that we didn't have the traditional dome.
We head upstairs and stop in at the governor's ceremonial office. A big fancy chair sits behind a big fancy desk where the governor signs bills. And it's a hit with school children.
Lots of the kids have had a chance to sit in it and pretend to be governor.
Would you mind if I went and sat in the chair?
All right. I think you better do it.
I'm going to be a little snoop and look in some of the drawers here, which sadly appear to be empty. Oh, you know, I better not tell people about that, but there are a lot of pens in there, ceremonial pens. I'm just going to close this drawer. Maybe I better get away from this desk before I cause any trouble. What's one thing that most people who come to the Capitol don't see, but you wish they would?
Oh, that's a hard one.
Bell thinks about it, then takes me over to see James Golding. He's the Senate reading clerk, and he leads me into a small room directly behind the Senate chambers.
This room here is dedicated to Senator Catherine Clark,
who was the first woman elected to the Oregon Senate, and she was elected in 1915.
The room is furnished to look like a room in the previous Capitol building, which burned down in 1935.
Certain articles were actually carried out of the building as it was on fire, and so we've brought some of those pieces back here to this Capitol to display.
The current Capitol survived a small fire in 2008, but big changes are possibly on the horizon. Oregon lawmakers will soon consider a major upgrade in hopes of making the building more modern and more likely to withstand an earthquake. If approved, the multi-year renovation would change the way everybody at the Capitol works, including me. As we wrap up our tour, I have one last question for Frankie Bell.
When you give tours, or when you have given tours in the past, do people want to go see where the press work?
I have never been asked to go see where the press works.
I'm crushed. It's some really great cubicles down there.
But I'm sure that if they knew you were there, they'd want to come and see you.
You're very kind.
The Oregon State Capitol turns 75 years old on October 1st. The party is already underway and lasts through October 5th. I'm Chris Lehman in Salem.
50 years ago today, President John F. Kennedy stepped off a Marine helicopter into the dry heat of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in southeast Washington. He was there to see the massive new N reactor. The reactor was the first to produce both plutonium and power in the U.S. As correspondent Anna King reports, the visit was also part of Kennedy's efforts to de-escalate the Cold War.
Hanford worker Bill McCullough remembers September 26, 1963, clearly when President Kennedy came to visit.
It was a very hot day, and we hit bumper-to-bumper traffic.
His 1958 Chevrolet Nomad was stuck behind a long line of cars. No wind, no AC. The whole family was roasting. He, his wife, and six children, two of which were twins, just 4 months old.
Well, we never believed much in babysitters. We always took our family every place.
McCullough says it was a notable day because for the first time ever, families of Hanford workers were able to see the secretive site.
We were just tickled to death to have the notoriety, if you will, the fact that, you know, here's something, first ever in the world did they ever try to make power out of a nuclear reactor. And it's an honor to be a part of it.
It may be possible for us to find a more peaceful world. That is our intention. But I want you to know that the effort that you have made and invested, the talents which have been at work here, I think on several occasions, have contributed to the security of the United States and in a very large sense to the peace of the world.
Kennedy's message was aimed at de-escalating the Cold War. The Cuban Missile Crisis had just happened a year earlier. Michelle Gerber is a Richland-based historian.
We would have the red telephone line, the hotline, if people remember that, between his office and the premier of the Soviet Union. So there couldn't be any mistakes and accidental pushing of buttons. And so he was really trying to dial back the Cold War. And he'd become essentially a Renaissance man, whereas before that he'd been very warlike, very hawkish.
But dedicating this massive war machine at Hanford didn't jive with Kennedy's new policies. By having the N reactor also produce electricity, Kennedy was able to portray the reactor as something more peaceful.
And so coming here was just about the turning point.
Kennedy was assassinated just 8 weeks after the Hanford visit. Historian Gerber says now, 50 years later, Hanford's a messy museum on the Northwest landscape. The nearby Columbia Generating Station still produces nuclear energy, but the N reactor was mothballed in 1987. Most of the plutonium made on the site was to help build the nation's arsenal for war. But Kennedy's visit gave this nuclear town some hope of a peaceful future. I'm Anna King in Richland.
That's all for today's edition of The Bridge. The Bridge airs Tuesday and Thursday mornings at 9. On Tuesday, we'll hear about a new project by the Clatsop Community College Library with assistance from Coast Community Radio. How has your life been affected by a library? The college is gathering stories with the goal of recording testimonials. With permission, some of the testimonials will be broadcast on this station. Thanks for listening this morning. We welcome your feedback on the show. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's N-E-W-S, then the numeral 1, at kmun.org. Let us know what you think, and please let us know about stories you'd like to hear about. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.